Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. More than a month ago, the United States announced that it was on the verge of an historic agreement with Saudi Arabia to extend the kind of defense guarantees that allies like Israel and South Korea have enjoyed for decades. Of course, this is the same administration which recently announced that non-existent Gaza ceasefires had all but been agreed, so timing is not their long suit. But there is plenty of evidence that the Biden administration has feverishly been negotiating something with the Saudis. Moreover, the idea seems to be in the deal of the century category. A three-way agreement with U.S. defense guarantee and advanced technology transfer for the Saudis, who would roll back their recently strengthened economic and tech relationship with the Chinese, while at the same time opening diplomatic relations with Israel, who, for their part, would end the Gaza war and commit to the two-state solution with the Palestinians in return for Saudi recognition and continued close American military support. In other words, a totally new Middle East. All I can say is, wow, but you, the audience, deserve more than that. If anyone can help us separate fact from fiction, or perhaps from fantasy, it is my guest today on New Thinking for a New World, Neil Quilliam. Neil is a British expert on Saudi Arabia and more generally the Arab Gulf, who wears many hats, including being a fellow at Chatham House in London, and who has just returned from the Gulf. Welcome back, Neil.
Thank you. Thanks, Alan. Good to be back.
Neil, I honestly don't know where to start. After all, in 2019, then presidential candidate Joe Biden vowed to make Saudi Arabia, quote, pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are, unquote. Now his government seems to be offering them an amazing defense, nuclear, and AI deal. Before we go into the details of what's going on, has Saudi Arabia changed that much, going from pariah to potential ally of the United States in just a few years? Or has the United States and Biden changed that much?
I think it's the United States and Biden that's changed. I mean, I think Saudi Arabia has just almost continued on the same trajectory it's been more or less from 2015. I mean, obviously, there have been a series of sort of, you know, foreign policy mishaps and blunders, which are very well known and very well understood. But I think the Saudi leadership under Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, is, you know, pushing in one direction. And that's, you know, that's essentially transforming the country, transforming the economy, trying to move away, you know, from or to break its dependency on hydrocarbons. I don't think it's changed its direction. There's been some, you know, tinkering around our edges. There have been some lessons learned, a little bit of recalibration. But it just strikes me that the U.S. or the Biden administration, you know, has gone from one pole almost to the other pole. And when I hear, you know, comments coming from the U.S., you know, from U.S. Secretary Blinken, that, you know, the deal is nearly signed, or it just needs ink, or that I hear from Saudi Foreign Minister Prince, you know, Faisal bin Farhan, that we're really close. I'm always shocked because I think, well, how did you get there from where you started a few years back? And are you really that close? Because what did we all miss in the interim?
Exactly. So let's talk about the pieces. First, let's start with the Saudis. What do they want from the United States? And what do they need from the United States?
I mean, ultimately, what they want, you know, is a defense agreement. As you said at the outset, you know, a defense agreement on par with South Korea, Japan, the Philippines. That's, you know, that's been part of their ambition for, you know, some time. They live, you know, in a rough, tough neighborhood. Yes, there has been de-escalation with Iran, but, you know, that's probably more of a temporary setting. But ultimately, what they want is, you know, a guarantee, an agreement, an ironclad agreement that can withstand, you know, change in U.S. administration. So therefore, you know, passes through Congress, is codified into law, that they can feel 100% secure that the U.S. will, you know, come to their rescue should Iran or other states, I mean, one's mostly thinking of Iran, attack it or get up to, you know, major mischief. That's the bottom line.
Let's take that second piece first. This, as you suggest, almost by definition, is aimed at Tehran. They seem to be, although the Houthis may have something to say about this, they seem to be the obvious candidate for a potential attacker in some future scenario. Although, as you know much better than I, the Saudis and the Iranians recently announced a diplomatic relationship.
Yes, I mean,
just a question, though, is this just a nice to have legacy of the past? Is it something that MBS popped out of his kit bag because he didn't think he could get it? Or is it wishing on a dream? If I could have anything in the world, I'd like a South Korean-like deal.
So I think when we're thinking about MBS and we're thinking about Saudi Arabia, you know, the change in the country, the sort of, you know, the economic transformation, the transition is very real. It's irreversible. It's moving forward. Everything is about that transformation. Everything is about the economy. And it's said often, and I think it's true, that there needs to be stability in the region. Saudi Arabia needs to feel entirely secure to bring in that investment and to help the economy, you know, through the next sort of 10, 15 years to transform, to transition to the kind of towards the post-hydrocarbon economy, we'll say. So part of that is ensuring that Saudi Arabia's security is guaranteed. And there's only one country, whether that's pie in the sky or not, that can do that. And that's the US. No one else can do that. However one looks at China, however one looks at that aspect of the relationship, obviously China's not going to come in and play, you know, security guarantor. Regional dynamics aren't sufficiently strong, aren't sufficiently sort of persuasive that, you know, MBS can sort of buy into that. It's got to be the US. That's the only country that can do that. So I don't think it's a nice to have. I think it's something that he probably believes is attainable. And it's something that he really wants. It's ambitious, yes, but that's what he really wants.
The other piece you mentioned, of course, was your words, ironclad, which, at least in the way the world used to work, required a treaty that requires the Senate. And as you know, we don't do treaties terribly often anymore. We certainly don't pass this kind of commitment through the Senate. Is there something short of that Saudi Arabia MBS would accept, or must this be documented, signed, and actually written into law in a way that only the Congress can do, the president cannot do?
I think it's got to be documented and signed into law. I guess lessons from the JCPOA.
There's a long list of examples. Yes, that the Iranian nuclear deal is certainly one of them.
Right. So that's very much in the mind. And in a way, you know, if one looks at the sort of de-escalation with Iran, there's a risk, you know, that you could walk away from that de-escalation to get a security or a defense agreement. But the defense agreement has to be sufficient, and that's why I say ironclad. An ironclad that they can comfortably walk away from the de-escalation, because at the moment it's neither nor. De-escalation is there, but how long? You know, that's not an institutionalized process. That could just change at any given moment. So the trade-off to let go of that would have to be a treaty with the U.S. That's worth it. That's worth taking that risk.
The irony of the timing, of course, is that the U.S. has been more or less on a path of withdrawing from the Middle East for some time now, post the Iraq invasions post-Afghanistan. So in a sense, it would require the United States being willing to exchange a guarantee for presence, one would imagine, which is a bizarre way to run a railroad, but maybe it makes sense in foreign policy terms.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think that perhaps in foreign policy terms, I mean, we've had, I mean, ever since, you know, the Arab Spring, there's been the question about, you know, reliability on the US, right? I mean, that's, you know, that's a well-documented.
I forgot to tell our audience that you used to be a diplomat.
I'll try to step out of that space. I left it some time ago, so let's see what I can do. Major concern, especially amongst the Gulf Arab states, you know, that the US is no longer the dependable, reliable friend that it once was.
Let me pull on that string. Is that part of the motivation for this, to try to keep the US anchored in the region?
Well, I think there's been a process of thought here. I think there was a sense or understanding that the US was pivoting to Asia, whatever, was on its way out. So there was a time, there was a sort of interregnum, I think, when the Gulf states in particular were looking at sort of diversifying, or thinking about how do we diversify, you know, our key relationships in the region and security relationships. And I think there was probably some sort of dalliance of thought, you know, with China, perhaps with India, and after the sort of the Iranian attacks against Khorasan and Abkhaz in 2019, you know, there was a real sense, actually the US aren't that dependable friend that we once thought they were. So, you know, so we have to work around this. And then, you know, the Gulf states point to all sorts of issues, like, you know, the Obama's red line, and, you know, a series of episodes that kind of demonstrate that. But ironically, or not ironically, but after Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, you know, when the U.S. seemingly looked a lot more muscular again in how it responded, I think there was some very quiet cheerleading on the side from the Gulf states saying, yay, you know, the U.S. is back. This is the U.S. we know and love. If it's going to do that for the Ukraine, then, you know, it has that capacity. It has that muscularity. It hasn't walked away. We can sort of, you know, anchor it back down into the Gulf. And I think for me, that was a sort of pivotal moment when it was, you know, we still have, maybe we don't have full confidence that it's going to come to us, but the U.S. has, you know, has shown its teeth. So therefore, we can now try to anchor it back in. And so that's kind of where I see that moment of change, certainly in the Gulf. And there seems to be a restored hope that, you know, the US is coming back in some form or other.
There are also, again, still on what Saudi wants or might get out of this deal, there are some economic pieces which sound, from the way you've talked about it so far, very much secondary, which have to do with civilian nuclear power, have to do with artificial intelligence, both of which are part of MBS's long-term transformation strategy. Those, I assume, are, in my terminology, nice to have, as they're not central. What is central is defense.
Yes, no, I agree. I mean, I think they are nice to have. Defense, I think defense, if you like, that's the crown jewels. The rest is all the, you know, the pretty diamonds and the scepter that sort of goes alongside that. But I do see the Saudis, I mean, the Gulf states, but the Saudis in particular, sort of seeing themselves as playing, you know, an important role in sort of the US's de-risking strategy with China. You know, it's trying to position itself as, you know, a logistics hub, as a new sort of manufacturing base. So positioning itself geographically, also investing considerably inside the kingdom itself to sort of develop, you know, its minerals industry, to sort of establish and set up sort of, you know, chip manufacturing processes. So it's, that's sort of where the economic piece can sort of fit in, or at least that's where it sees itself as fitting in.
That's a good segue to what does the U.S. want out of this deal? Because, again, the Americans, after the Abraham Accords, seem to have shifted entirely to an economic strategy. We want a coherent Middle East economy that we can benefit from. Was withdrawing militarily, although we still have 40, the U.S. still has 40,000 troops in the region. Why is this important, do you think, to Washington?
I mean, in a way, I think it's part of a longer term shift eastwards. And I think it's trying to help the regional states. And this is, there's a lot of ironies in this at the moment, of course, but help the regional states work together, cohere together. This is why sort of normalization is such a key piece of sort of, Israel's integration into the region. I mean, it's hard to say that now without really thinking that through very carefully. If we wind back a couple of years, it's a bit different. But almost, almost tying Saudi, UAE, Bahrain is small, but part of that with Israel as a strong economic security construct that would allow, the U.S. to maintain its economic interests there, but lighten its military, its security footprint. I mean, that was the original idea, at least. But obviously, following the attacks on the 7th of October and what we've seen since, I mean, that really sort of throws a huge spanner in the works of that model. But I suspect, there's still a strong push for that, or there will be at some point.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on TelbergFoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
The way you set that up seems to dismiss the pushing China out motive, which some have brooded about. And indeed, I saw a statement from a Saudi businessman the other day in the artificial intelligence space who's done a deal recently with the Chinese, who's saying, yep, if I'm told to drop that deal, I'll drop it like a hot potato in favor of this new world that the crown prince is negotiating. So is this, that might be from an American point of view, a nice thing. The Chinese, you blunt a little bit of their initiative, but you don't see it as core.
I don't see it as core. I don't, certainly not from the economic side. On the, on defense, on technology, yes. I mean, it's sort of, shoring up, I guess, if you like, shoring up U.S. allies, guaranteeing and making sure that they're not, trailing off to China in this kind of contested space. But I don't think that's the core of what I'm seeing playing out in the region.
Well, one element, at least from the Saudi point of view of this, has been being permitted to purchase yet more advanced military technology. And clearly there has been some degree of movement between the Saudis and China on exactly military technology. So there may be that aspect to it. This is the Saudis saying, yep, we'll commit ourselves to stay with American high technology, especially if you give us the highest technology, which is what they've pushed for decades and maybe is an important part of this potential deal.
Yes, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I was on a panel last week in Doha at the Global Security Forum, and I was asked a question about where I saw the sort of Gulf states sort of sitting and fitting between China and the US and Saudi in particular. I mean, clearly, the Saudis want to sort of leverage their advantage. But I don't see them as hedging one against the other. As far as I'm concerned, Saudi Arabia is firmly in the US camp. I think if push comes to shove, it will come out and make that point very publicly, but I think privately, I think that point is really very well understood. Yes, it can leverage against China to get, you know, better high tech material from the US and used to its advantage. But I have no doubt that it very firmly sits sort of on the US side of the fence.
So October 7th changes, if not everything, a lot. Clearly, it has shocked Israel, and even as we speak, they're pushing further into Rafah. Clearly, some of what hasn't happened, the Arab street is quiet. Nobody's broken relationships with Israel. There's noise, but not lots of noise. We recently had an Arab summit, which, to be brutally frank, more or less said what they say at every Arab summit for the history of Arab summits. So it didn't react as though this is a dramatic change. Yet it's nonetheless a bit hard to imagine the Saudis agreeing to normalize relationships in this current context. Doesn't October 7th at least put a spanner in the works, if not kill this thing for the foreseeable future? Or am I missing something?
No, I don't think you're missing something. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that there are a couple of points to make on that. You know, you alluded to the Arab street. And I think having traveled around the region a lot recently, you do see protests, you do see demonstrations in states other than, you know, in the Gulf, and anti-Israeli sentiment is very, unsurprisingly, is very strong right across the region. There, you know, the states that have relations with Israel, I mean, UAE, Bahrain, long-running ties between Egypt and Jordan, are secure state-to-state, regime-to-regime. But even there, you know, there's a sense of despair with how Netanyahu is acting. It's like, you know, how can we have, there's no choice. You know, peace treaties are there. They have to be maintained. But there is, this feels quite different to episodes in the past where I think the sentiment at the popular or public level is very, very strong. There are very few, if any, avenues to express that. You know, only a few countries like Jordan will allow, you know, protests. But that in a sense will act as a constraint on policymakers. And I think that will act as a constraint on MBS. MBS is very interesting because, you know, he has made very bold moves in the past. And I think if he believed it was in Saudi Arabia's interest to normalize, then I think he would just go ahead and do that. You know, he has that kind of confidence, I guess. But on this case where sentiment in the country is clearly highly sensitized, much more so than it would have been a few years ago. I think had it been a few years ago, he could have pushed through quite comfortably. But, you know, the images, you know, that everyone's seeing on a daily basis just makes the idea of normalization just, as you said at the beginning, sort of fantastical. It's just a fantasy. And then how could you shift from, you know, trading normalization to go into a two-state solution? Whether one believes two-state solution is dead or alive, I mean, we are so far away from it at the moment. So trading one for the other, that's just mind-boggling.
Yet, as you and I both know, the negotiations continue probably literally as we're talking, with the carrot for the Israelis of that sure path towards a two-state solution. I don't know what those words mean in this current context. They keep on using them. As in terms of domestic American politics, as you implied earlier, that requires a Senate vote. Completely unimaginable that, absent the Israeli piece of this, the Senate would support a deal with the Saudis. I'm not so sure it will under any circumstances. That's a different issue for a different time. But nonetheless, absent the Israeli piece, yet the Israelis have shown, near as I can tell, zero interest both the current administration and many others in the Israeli elite don't seem to be part of this conversation. That has leads to two questions. One is, as they say in the business, less for less. The Saudis would stand up and say, fine, we'll do a deal with the U.S. just on our issues. The National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, is on record saying, no, it's either all or nothing. And then the second question is going to be the derivative of that is, what if it is nothing? What might be the consequences of failure, if any, from this fantastic negotiation? So two pieces.
So all or nothing, I mean, for the Saudis, the all or nothing is still, you know, it's still the defense agreement, is the defense treaty.
All has a different definition for them.
So, you know, as you said, I think without normalization, I can't see how the peace treaty is going to come into being. Even if with normalization, as you say, I mean, whether that gets through Congress is another matter. So, I don't see the Saudis sort of wanting to sit at the table and negotiate a subpar or come to an agreement on a subpar agreement where it doesn't get that defense treaty, because it leaves it exposed, it leaves it vulnerable to Iran. There may be some sweeteners around that, but ultimately this is, like I said, this is the crown jewels. This is what it's after. I can't see them accepting anything less than, you know, the full deal. So I mean, we may see some kind of fudge of an agreement, a fudge of a deal between the two, but it's ultimately, it's not going to be very meaningful in that sense. And sorry, Alan, your second question.
If it's not just a fudge, but it simply fails, are there consequences? Do the Saudis have options? Or is this nothing ventured, nothing gained? It's okay. We'll wait and see what happens in American politics, which after all is we're months away from an election, which will have consequences.
I mean, I think it's nothing ventured, nothing gained. I think it's just, I mean, MBS, you know, is young, will soon succeed his father. He's got a long term of office ahead of him, as long as, you know, nothing untoward happens to him. I think they can, you know, they can sit, they, you know, they can wait this out. And there's no prospect of any movement on the front with Israel. So in a way, they've got no choice other than just to sit on the sidelines and you know, do what they're doing. Just wait for the situation to change, which ironically is something, you know, that the Assad family has learned to do quite well in Syria. Just sit on there, wait for whatever administration is going to come into being, and see how that plays out. Maybe wait for post Netanyahu government to sort of come into place and see how that shakes down. There's limited time between now and the presidential election to get anything really done and anything meaningfully done. I mean, the Saudis do like to get things done. I mean, they move very, very slowly. Then suddenly they want things to happen overnight. So I could see if they thought there was a prospect of getting something like this done, then they would. But they can live with the status quo and see who comes into the White House next January.
But even on the Saudi side, you mentioned that the transition to Crown Prince becoming king, which is to say the king passing away, seems nearer than further. I find it, again, fantastical that King Salman would want his legacy to be a deal with the Israelis. So even the timing on their side has struck me as, frankly, bizarre. On the one hand, you've got American politics with potentially a president who never called them a pariah, who likes to do mega deals, and who doesn't understand the boundaries of what can be done or not done in the Middle East, as we saw when he was president. Although a president also potentially that is more talk than action, fair point. I've begun to wonder if this round of negotiations, clearly being pushed by the United States side, clearly we are the demandor. I've been wondering if this isn't a bit like the negotiation on Afghanistan that Biden inherited. Trump had cut a deal de facto with the Afghans that implied some things. Biden then executed it and left, took in that case the hit for having done so. Might it be that Blinken and Sullivan and the president are doing some of the hard lifting now that a President Trump, if there were to be a President Trump, who, like the Saudis, thinks of himself as the decider, could come in and suddenly wave his magic wand and say, okay, and it's done. Is that scenario plausible?
It's plausible that the groundwork has been carried out, or the foundations for a deal have been put in place. But I don't think it's as easy as Trump coming in with a magic wand and, you know, waving it, and suddenly a deal of the century materializing. I mean, there's still a lot of work. There's still a lot, you know, if you think about the foundations, I mean, there's still a long way to go before you get anywhere to putting a roof on top of that. And I think that would take, you know, a very strong, very committed Trump administration to really, you know, continue with that project. And it couldn't just become some, you know, waving of the wand, some magic that's just going to magic away all the pain and all the hurt, and just suddenly come up with a wonderful phantasmagorical deal. So yes, the foundations may be there, but it's going to take a long time to build, and things in, you know, things in Israel are really going to have to shift, and it can't happen without Israel. It can't happen without normalization.
Let's leave it there, because I agree 100%. I'd go further and say I actually don't think it can happen, and I'm not so persuaded. And now I'm speaking as an American, that it is necessarily in the U.S. national interest to pursue this. But clearly, we'll be able to have another conversation about this, probably not before January 20th, but one way or the other, I suspect after January 20th. So, Neil, thank you very much. When you signed up for the Middle East all those decades ago, I suspect you did not imagine that these kinds of things would be in your future.
Absolutely not. No, I had no idea what I was signing up for. And I have to say, I mean, I've been focusing on the Middle East for a long time, and there have been times when I thought, I need to leave it behind. I need to go and do something else, but it just keeps dragging me back and back. So I'm going to be with it for some time to come, I think. And things have shifted so much since, you know, I first engaged, and I just imagine it's just going to continue like that. So would very much love to, you know, come back and continue the conversation sometime in 2025.
We would do that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.